Thank you and good afternoon. Northrim is pleased to kick off the second season of the Northrim Bank Oil and Gas Speaker Series presented by the Alaska World Affairs Council. Today's presentation is the first of four this year in the series, and the information about the future speakers is on your table. Northrim Bank is engaged in the community and committed to growing our economy by providing capital and expertise to help businesses and individuals meet their financial goals. Another way that we are engaged is through sponsorship of events like this and others that focus on policies that can help responsibly develop our natural resources. We're blessed to live here, and we encourage everyone to join us in these efforts because we believe it's critical to the economic future of Alaska. You'll find additional information on these topics on our website at alaskanomics.com. Northrim also produces twice yearly an Alaska economic update written by Mark Edwards, who's a vice president with us in the commercial lending department and also our bank economist. Topics include housing, per capita income, a whole variety of factors that influence our economy. And the most recently updated version of this is available at the back table for your review. It's now my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Dr. Margo Thorning. Dr. Thorning is a senior vice president and chief economist with the American Council for Capital Formation and director of research for its public policy think tank. Dr. Thorning has frequently testified as an expert witness on capital formation, tax, energy, environmental policies before multiple U.S. congressional committees. Dr. Thorning has also traveled coast to coast to present findings to state and local lawmakers, business organizations, and the media on the economic impact of climate change policies on local job and economic growth. Dr. Thorning is an internationally recognized expert on tax, environmental, and competitiveness issues. She writes and lectures on tax and economic policy and is frequently quoted in op-eds in numerous publications and has appeared internationally on public affairs news programs. Previously, Dr. Thorning served in the U.S. Department of Energy, the U.S. Department of Commerce, and the Federal Trade Commission. She received a BA from Texas Christian University, an MA in economics from the University of Texas, and her PhD in economics from the University of Georgia. Margo Thorning is here today to speak to us on U.S. energy and tax policy implications for Alaska. So please join me in giving a warm Alaskan welcome to Dr. Thorning.
Too short. Thank you. I understand that the Alaska World Affairs Council was looking for a speaker who could charm you with her talent and her wit and her sparkling personality, and I'm pleased to be filling in while the search continues. But thank you again for being here, and I'm so delighted to see all the younger people here too, because the issues that we're talking about are very important, not only to the U.S. as a whole, but in particular for Alaska. And so I'd like to run through a few slides and then hopefully finish right on time and then have really good questions from the audience. When I was asked to come, I thought, well, what's important? We need to talk about the role of energy in the U.S. economy. We need to talk about how tax policy may impact new investment. And then we probably should talk about the tax reform proposals that are being discussed in the public policy community, especially in Washington, and then try to relate it all back to what's going on in Alaska. So first, the role of energy in U.S. economic growth. I wanted to share with you a slide, and I hope you can see it in the back of the room. Oh, since 2009, when the recession ended, the states that have enjoyed the fastest growth in personal income are the ones that are, I don't know if this is going to work that far, but yeah, I'm sorry, I think my the distance is too great. So the dark blue states are the ones who have grown at approximately 27% in real terms since the end of the recession. And you notice that those are states like North Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, Texas, and Oklahoma. And Alaska is one of the paler states. Your personal income has only grown about 10%. And the striking thing about the states where the economic growth is strongest is that those are the ones where oil and gas production has been booming. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about a study that Wood Mackenzie, the internationally known consulting firm, put out. They were looking at what it would mean for the U.S. economy as a whole, and I put up some production data for oil and gas there, contrasting a current policies case with a development policies case. And the dark blue line at the top shows the increase in oil and gas production if development policies, which allowed access to federal lands that are currently, you know, not allowed to be explored on, resumption of or allowed drilling in New York State, increased permitting in the Gulf of Mexico, approval of the Keystone Pipeline, and state regulation of shale gas operations. So if those policies were put in place, we would expect to see a substantial increase in oil and gas production for the U.S. as a whole. And to just show you the numbers, which hopefully you see the increase in production from 2015 to 2030 by about, compared to the baseline case, 10 million barrels a day of oil equivalent, increased jobs of about 1.4 million by 2030, and annual revenues, or total revenues in 2030 for the federal government of almost $100 billion. So the impact on the U.S. as a whole is real strong. They also did a case for Alaska. They did one for all the oil and gas producing states. And for Alaska, they assumed that the resources offshore and NPRA would be developed. ANWR production would begin in 2017. Environmental regulation of shale gas and tight oil wouldn't be unduly burdensome. Permitting levels would be sufficient to develop resources in a timely manner, and they also assumed there was no ACES. The properties that are being developed would not be subject to ACES, the tax that went in place in 2007. And if those policies were put in place, according to the Wood Mackenzie study, there would be a substantial increase in Alaska's oil and gas oil production, for example. And now I think you're producing at a rate of about somewhere over 400,000 barrels a day. And by 2020, that would be up to over 600,000. And by 2030, by 2020, up to over 1 million barrels a day, and by 2030, up to 2.4 million barrels a day. And employment would be significantly higher. By 2020, there would be an additional 135,000 jobs, and by 2030, almost 170,000. And federal state tax revenues would be up by 2030 by approximately $21 billion. So it would be a real boost to the Alaskan economy if development policies were put in place, such as assumed by the Wood Mackenzie study. It would mean a lot in terms of jobs up here and state tax receipts. Now, taking a look at what's going on right now in Alaska, you can see a significant decline in production, and this is your Department of Revenue estimates, from the beginning of, say, 2001 down to 2011. As I said, you're down to somewhere over 400,000 barrels a day. And, you know, unless this trend is reversed, it's going to continue to decline, according to the Department of Revenue. Another way of looking at that is to contrast Alaskan oil production with what's going on in the lower 48. The blue curve at the top shows the increase in lower 48 production over the last decade or so, since 2003, and the red line shows the decline in Alaskan oil production since 2003. So, the question is, what's the reason for the decline? what potentially could be done to reverse the decline in Alaskan oil production, since 90% of your tax revenue comes in from oil and gas, so it's, you know, extremely important to the citizens to see if production could be enhanced. Well, I want to share with you a new study from some Harvard and World Bank economists, and I apologize before I put the slide up because it's a little bit hard to follow, but we'll interpret it the best we can. But these Harvard and World Bank economists looked at 85 different countries for the year 2004, and they got the PricewaterhouseCoopers in all those 85 countries to tell them what was the effective tax rate on new investment on a standardized asset. So they were comparing apples to apples in all these 85 countries, and they chose ceramic pots because every country produces ceramic pots. So they looked at all the taxes that would impact investment. And I realize that's not the same as a drilling rig, but you know, in order to assess, to compare apples to apples, they picked this one asset. And then they looked at how that country's percent of investment as a percent of GDP related to the change related to corporate tax rates. Now, I know that looks like a Rorschach test or something, but what that is a scatter diagram of those 85 countries. And as you can see, there's a trend line going down that shows that the higher the corporate tax rate along the horizontal axis, and it goes from zero to about 40%, the higher the corporate tax rate, the lower investment is as a share of GDP, investment and GDP on the horizontal axis, on the vertical axis, pardon me. Now, the U.S., at least we were able to find the U.S. in that blur, and you can see that the effective tax rate on new investment, the corporate tax rate, is about 18 or 19% here in the U.S., and investment as a percent of GDP in the U.S. is around 16, 17%. Other countries, for example, you know, the far right country is Bolivia. Their tax rate is about 40% on corporate investment, and they have a very low investment as a percent of GDP. On the far left of the graph is Hong Kong, HKG, and Mongolia. They have almost a zero tax rate on corporate investment, and perhaps not coincidentally, investment is a much larger share of GDP. Well, why do we care about investment? We care about investment because it's what determines productivity growth, it determines increases in real wages, it determines how big our economic pie can get. So investment is critical. And so I thought it would be helpful for you to look at what some of the best scholars I've been able to find have concluded about the impact of corporate tax rates on investment. This study concluded that every 10 percentage point increase in the corporate tax rate reduces investment by 2 percentage points. So it's a very significant impact. And these results, I encourage you to look at the full study if you're interested there. I think it's one of the better studies I've run across. So looking at that and understanding that tax rates do matter and they do impact investment decisions, let's look at the situation here that's important to you, which is tax rates on investment in Alaska in oil in the oil industry. As you can see from this international comparison, the Alaskan tax rate under ACES is close to, well, it's over 80% according to these data, whereas the U.S. Gulf of Mexico, the far bar on the far left, is approximately 42%. Other states, including some in Canada, the tax rate is significantly lower. So taking a look in closer detail at how Alaskan taxes compare to some of the states in the lower 48, you can see the top curve is the Alaska taxes on Prudhoe Bay oil, and the tax rate, of course, is approaching, you know, it's over 60% per barrel at $100. I think that's $100 per barrel state tax. And the other states, the low bars, California, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Louisiana, and Wyoming, much less. So looking at Alaska's, the impact that the tax rate may be having on investment here in Alaska, I use some data from the Commonwealth North study that looked at constant dollar investment spending in the North Slope compared to the nominal non-adjusted data for the last decade. So since 2001, the red line at the top is the inflation-adjusted real spending on capital expenditures in the North Slope. You can see it's fallen substantially in terms of from, you know, over $3.5 billion down to somewhere around maybe $2.5 billion. So in real terms, investment is not really, it's falling here. So that's probably part of the explanation for the sharp decline in production. Now, enough about Alaska for the moment. Let's turn to the other topic I was asked to address, which is tax reform proposals that are being discussed among policymakers not only in Washington, but of course around the country. We expect after the election that in the next Congress, probably tax reform will become a significant issue because people recognize that the U.S. tax system is onerous, overly complex. The tax rate on corporate income, for example, is 35%. The OECD countries are now averaging under 30%, and many countries significantly lower. In addition, the tax rate on individuals is also considered unduly complex. So there's a lot of interest in reforming the U.S. tax code with the hope of making it more efficient, making it stimulate economic growth. So I thought I would just run through a few of the more prominent tax reform proposals. The President's Commission on, let me just put up all the bullets. President's Commission on Deficit Reduction released a plan, the Bowles-Simpson plan, in November of 2010, and it promptly went into the circular file. The administration ignored it, and other folks did too. But this was a bipartisan bill that would have lowered the income tax on individuals from the current 35% down to 22 to 28%. Would have reduced the corporate tax rate to 26 to 28%. It would have repealed the AMT. It would have eliminated what we call tax expenditures. And those are not, that's a term of art, if you will, in Washington. Tax expenditures are all the deductions that the Joint Tax Committee considers a deviation from a straight income tax. So accelerated depreciation is a tax expenditure, as is your deduction for mortgage interest. That's a tax expenditure. So basically, the Bowles-Simpson plan would eliminate every deduction that you currently take and every deduction that your company currently takes. It would have imposed a territorial tax system, which means foreign source income would not be subject to tax. Most of our competitors already have a territorial system. And finally, it would have been deficit neutral. But as I say, it dropped like a stone in Washington, and now there seems to be some interest in reviving it, but remains to be seen whether it'll be one of the leading candidates. Another proposal for tax reform has been put forth by the Obama administration. This plan would increase the marginal tax rate to 38.6%. Would replace the AMT with a Buffett rule, which would mean everybody would pay at least 30%. It would reduce the top corporate tax rate to 28%. And it would provide special incentives for domestic manufacturing, including for renewable energy. It would eliminate a lot of the business tax deductions that you currently use, including last-in, first-out accounting, and would eliminate accelerated depreciation. It would also take away some of the provisions that the oil and gas industry currently uses, like geological and geophysical deductions and intangible drilling costs. And it would take away Section 199 for the oil and gas industry. It would reduce the deductibility of corporate interest expense and tax foreign source income at 28%. So it's quite a different set of initiatives than the Bowles-Simpson. Then there is the Romney tax plan, and since he's running for office, you might be interested in that. It would reduce the tax rate to approximately 28% on individuals, eliminate AMT, would eliminate many tax expenditures, or he would cap deductions. I noticed in the debates, the second debate, he said that he would cap deductions at $17,000 for a family. So that would mean you could choose, if you want to use your deduction for your mortgage interest, you could use up to $17,000. So that would mean upper income people wouldn't get to write off as many deductions as they currently do. And it would avoid having to make the hard choice about eliminating mortgage interest versus eliminating other things that, like charitable deductions. It would transition to a territorial system, meaning no taxation on companies' foreign income. And it would create an investment tax credit and extend the bonus depreciation for another year. So that's one option. And the problem in Washington is that these two, you know, capital-intensive companies take advantage of accelerated depreciation and bonus depreciation and LIFO and so forth, whereas finance and insurance and wholesale retailers prefer a lower corporate rate. So there's been a battle going on in Washington for the last 2 or 3 years between these opposing forces of capital-intensive companies that worry about giving up depreciation, LIFO, and provisions used by oil and gas and bonus depreciation and so forth. But there is a compromise that is being discussed, which, let me just put all the bullets up so you can think about it, would slowly phase out slowly reduce over a 10-year period the taxation of corporate income, bringing it down from 35 to 25% over a 10-year period. And it would disallow 10% of interest deducted that companies currently can deduct all of. It would disallow 10% of that. It would make permanent the bonus depreciation rule, which helps keep the cost of capital low for new investment. It would gradually limit the deduction for home mortgage, phase out the deduction for state and local taxes, and repeal the AMT. And this is not a fully fleshed out system. It's just a framework for discussion to try to bridge this gap between capital-intensive companies and those that are, in the financial sector. So to me, this is something, you know, that we might want to give some thought to, because otherwise it's going to end up, you know, continuous battles, lobbyist against lobbyist, and make it hard to go forward on tax reform. So that's what the major outlines of the discussion are, and those are what the major options seem to be that policymakers are discussing. So just to wrap it up, it seems to me, getting back to what we started on, U.S. energy development and expansion is critical to U.S. economic security and energy security. Each 1% increase in gross domestic product in this country is accompanied by a 0.2% increase in energy use. So you can't get economic growth without increased energy use. And second, how federal and state tax reforms are structured will impact the cost of capital and will impact investment. I think the evidence from the economics profession is pretty strong that taxes do matter, and if you raise taxes and raise the cost of capital for investment, whatever the investment is, you're going to get less of it. And then finally, it seems to me that reversing Alaska's decline in oil production would be easier if tax rates were reduced. You might even want to think about broadening your tax base. I know that's anathema to most people, but 46 states have a sales tax. Most states do have an income tax, so it might be fruitful to consider broadening your tax base so that all of your eggs aren't in the one basket as they are right now. So let me stop and take questions. Thank you.
Well, Dr. Thorney, thanks for joining us and sort of giving us a guided path through the weeds of tax reform and capital investment, and we'll have you back at the microphone in just a second to answer questions from the audience here. But I just want to remind everybody, before you ask a question, we'd like to wait until the microphone gets to you because we are recording this for a future broadcast. And Dr. Thorney, we do have, on behalf of the Alaska World Affairs Council Board, a gift for you to take back to Washington, D.C. to remember this wonderful, not so a snowy trip, but certainly a cold trip to Alaska, and we hope you come back. And I know Lisa was trying to be quite comprehensive in her welcoming of everybody here, but we did have some legislative people we wanted to recognize for their attendance at our event today. And so there was Senator Kathy Geisel's office, Representative Shelley Hughes, Representative Bob Lynn, Representative Dan Sadler, thank you for joining us today. And I know there's going to be a question out there by somebody that says, where can we get these slides? And the answer is, they'll be on the Alaska World Affairs Council website, so if you'd like to peruse these a little bit further, feel free to come to the website, and it'll be there. And of course, you know, we are a membership-driven organization, and your memberships do help underwrite the continuance of these types of programs. And so if you found today's information of value, that it's helping you shape a more independent perspective of what some of the facts are that can impact your life, then we'd appreciate you taking the time and joining the Alaska World Affairs Council as a member. And then before I give up the microphone, we do want to invite you back to the November 16th program, with is going to be Farah Day Fari, and she's going to be speaking about Iran's nuclear policy and its impact on the region. So that'll be a very interesting, very timely topic, and it'll be here at the Hilton. And we want to invite you to RSVP before the event so that we can move the lunch line along and get everybody checked in a very prompt fashion. And with that, I'm going to invite Dr. Thorney back to the microphone, and again, please wait for the microphone to get to you, and Carrie over here has got it, so raise your hand, she'll get to you, and then we can have you ask questions. Dr. Thorney?
Thanks, Garrett.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. I have a sort of a comment on one slide and a question on another. The one slide that looked, in Alaska terms, more like a blast out of a 12-gauge shotgun with dots all over the place. I kind of doubt there was enough statistical rigor there to actually say anything from that slope that was drawn in. But the question is more about the following slide that implied a grossly different tax rate in Alaska versus the Gulf of Mexico. But that did not, as far as I could tell, take into account the differences in revenue sharing. And I'm wondering if you think that if Alaska got the same kind of deal that the coastal, that the Gulf Coast states do in terms of revenue sharing, whether that could flip the chart around or at least allow greater flexibility, greater leverage in Alaska tax policy.
I think that's over my head. Now, back to the, because I'm not an expert in, you know, exactly what goes on here in Alaska. Back to the your comment about the scatter diagram, that's statistically significant results. I encourage you to look at the American Economic Association, that's peer-reviewed journal. So I think, and that's not the only study that's looked at the impact of investment response to tax rates. So I do think those results are credible and ought to be given serious thought. And I'm not enough of an expert to know the difference, but the point is, if every barrel of oil here is taxed at close to 90%, the incentives to invest here in Alaska are clearly impacted vis-a-vis other states and other parts of the world where the tax rate is much lower. And I think the evidence of that is in the decline in capital expenditures here and the decline in oil production, even though, you know, the price of oil has gone up a whole lot in the last few years. So I think those are indications that tax policy here may not be optimal for getting production back up. Well, again, I'm not an expert. You may know more about that than I do, but the fact is that the companies don't get to benefit from the upside of price increases here, and that makes this investment climate less attractive than other states, in my opinion.
Thank you. Thank you, and thanks Northrim Bank for supporting this and the other sponsors. I also have that same type of question. I think you've already answered it, frankly. If you had investment money, would you invest it at a place where there's 82% tax on the product versus 50%? Shouldn't we be competing with North Dakota and Canada and the UK for our investment money rather than the other higher taxed provinces?
Well, that would be the implication I draw, looking at the production data here and looking at the growth in production in the lower 48. So a good observation, I would think.
Thank you very much for coming. I'd like to take advantage of your national perspective. Can you think of any other state that even comes close to Alaska in the percentage of its income, the state's income, that's derived from a sole source? Perhaps Nevada for gaming, but I can't think of any that comes close.
I think even, you know, when I looked at your data, I was stunned to see, you know, how heavily dependent you are on oil revenues for your state budget receipts. And I looked at Nevada, and I think they are, you know, they, you think of Nevada as a gaming state and a one industry place, but they do have some health industry there and other business, and they seem to be less dependent on gaming than Alaska is on oil and gas. So I think you're probably at the top in terms of depending on one industry for your budget receipts.
So I'm wondering, in your blurb that you wrote on the Alaska World Affairs Council blog, it says, without question, the U.S. needs to do everything it can to promote domestic energy, especially oil and gas. I think that's precisely the problem, that we're not looking at alternatives given the destructive nature of fossil fuels, the cause of global warming, acidification of the ocean, melting of the ice caps. It also seems that the majority of the oil left is difficult to access, whether it's offshore in the Arctic, whether it's fracking, the tremendously damaging tar sands of Alberta. So, and if you also look at the cost of oil, it's not taking into consideration, I guess, what would be called negative externalities, wars that are fought for oil, pollution, health costs, and the environmental destruction. So it just seems like a very narrow scope to not be looking at a broader context, and that maybe we need higher taxes to discourage these things and to actually take into consideration the full cost of oil and gas?
Well, those are all points that people do give serious consideration to. To think first about global warming. Global warming is a global issue, as the name connotes, and if we make energy, fossil energy, more expensive here in the U.S., it isn't going to reduce concentrations of GHGs in the atmosphere, because the growth in emissions is coming, as you know, in the developing countries of China, Latin America, Indonesia, places like that. So our emissions are actually expected to be flat out through 2035, according to the Department of Energy's Energy Information Administration. You have to think about what making fossil fuels more expensive means for people's income. If as I said, each 2%, each percentage increase in GDP is accompanied by a 0.2% increase in energy use. The Department of Energy projects that by 2035, fossil fuels are still going to be 75 or 80% of our fuel supply. So I think fossil fuels are probably here to stay, and renewables will grow, but slowly. Renewable energy, for example, offshore wind, as DOE published data last year that shows that it's about $270 levelized capital cost per kilowatt hour versus $62 for a natural gas plant, for example, to produce electricity. So renewable energy is certainly going to be part of our portfolio, but in many cases it's so much more expensive that it will, if it were, for example, if the country passed a clean energy standard, the Bingaman bill, for example, electricity prices will certainly rise. Higher electricity prices mean businesses can't grow as fast. Consumers have to spend more on electricity versus food, medicine, travel, trips to Las Vegas, et cetera. So you have to think about the overall macro consequences of making fossil energy more expensive. The switch to natural gas is now generating, I think, 35 or so percent of U.S. electricity. Coal share is falling, so that is helping reduce our growth in emissions, which, as I said, are expected to be flat for the next 20 years. So all of those are important issues that you raise, but when you put everything in context, it seems to me we need to think about U.S. economic growth, which has been so very slow. We need to think about, the 7.8% unemployment rate, the fact that college graduates are having a very tough time finding work in their fields. We need to focus on growing the economy while trying to reduce emissions, which we are.
Yeah, hi. How does our... I know almost nothing about oil taxes and whatnot. But how does our both the U.S. and Alaska tax structure differ from say Norway and Saudi Arabia? How do they tax the oil? How do they tax their oil? And do we have anything to learn from Norway and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and those guys? Thank you.
Well, again, I understand Norway has a fairly high tax on oil. I don't know how Saudi Arabia taxes it. There are probably people in the room who could address that question better than I can. But, the question is for you here in Alaska, your oil production is falling like a stone, and what are you going to do to fix it? And, since the tax increase in 2007, things are getting worse, not better. So, it would seem to me it might be worthwhile to consider what incentives do you need to have here in this state so that oil production and perhaps natural gas production can be enhanced.
Hi. First, I want to thank you for coming here and for all the hours you've had to spend on all the information you've had to assemble to come up with these answers and this information so we have something to work with.
I'm
going to do a little lead up to this question next. It's going to be two questions, and I can tell you one of them is going to be how do we price oil, and the other one, how much do we consume in our state? But before I get to those two questions, I want to preface them with this. I was in business for 25 years with a hotel. We did pricing. It's a very complicated and simple system. In order to get to your bottom line, you'll price a certain product for corporate for this price, senior citizens this price, groups this price, rack rate this price if you walk in, et cetera, et cetera. But the bottom line is you want to make so much profit. Now, to preface this, I want this mostly for the young folks in here. In order to come up with conclusions and wrap my brain around things, I reduce them to me personally. I think of how does it fit for me personally? That being said, I look as if I owned all the oil in our state. If it was my oil, what would I do? Number one, what I see is, it's in a fuel tank stored right now. It's stored, no cost. And so I think, well, when's the price gonna be better? This would be just one of my thoughts. Now, here's the two questions again. One, how do the oil companies price their product? And number two, how much do we consume in our state with airplanes, with boats, autos, heating fuel, et cetera? Thank you.
Well, I can't answer question two very well, but I can answer question one. Oil is priced internationally. Oil companies are price takers, not price makers. Our oil companies control relatively our domestic, our oil companies control maybe, I think, 7% of international reserves, somewhere around there. So oil prices are set by supply and demand globally. Our companies have to take whatever the price is in the market. So that's how that works. I honestly am not an expert on Alaska's particular oil consumption. I understand you use an awful lot of it for heating because you can't get at some of your gas reserves, use more heating oil than, from petroleum products than any other state. But again, there are probably people in this room who could answer that better than I.
Good afternoon. You spoke to an increase of the tax rate at 10%, lowering investment by 2%. Can we conclude the inverse, that for every percent we lower the tax rate, we can expect an increase in investment? And if so, by how much?
Well, bear in mind that study that I was talking about investment overall in each country as a percent of GDP. But I've noticed for years that countries with relatively low tax rates on corporate and individual income have much faster economic growth rates. I've been surprised that more hasn't been made of that. For example, some of the countries that broke free when the Soviet Union broke up significantly lowered their corporate tax rates, and investment in those countries has grown. But I think it's fair to generalize that a reduction in taxes in general, because it lowers the cost on investment, it lowers the cost of capital, it means the return that investment has to earn is less, so the hurdle rate for new investment is lower. I think it's fair to generalize that a lower tax rate, all other things equal, is going to incentivize investment.
Thank you, Doctor. Real brief question. We explained that higher oil taxes, higher corporate taxes, individual taxes reduce investment in our national as a percentage of GMP. Is it fair to assume we can reverse the impacts of that on our economy by switching those tax rates, by the reform you talked about, or are there longer-term consequences whereby we fall behind the power curve?
Well, that's a great question. I've, over the years, have looked at what type tax system promotes the strongest growth in countries. And there was a paper released about a decade ago by the Joint Tax Committee in Washington that combined a host of different studies which had analyzed the impact of switching to a consumed income tax, which is where all consumption is taxed, all saving and investment is tax exempt, to a pure income tax where there's no particular provisions for investment or for saving. And the bottom line was these six or eight different outstanding scholars and macro modelers who looked at both systems concluded that if we switched in the U.S. to a consumption tax with full expensing for investment, saving not taxed, no deduction for interest expense, our growth rate would be maybe 2% higher a year, and that's 2 percentage points higher a year. That's very significant. And subsequently, the American Council for Capital Formation asked Dr. Alan Sinai of Decision Economics to backcast what investment and job growth would have been in the U.S. had we imposed a consumed income tax, which is basically the Hall-Rabushka plan from Stanford or the David Bradford plan from Princeton University. And Alan Tsai and I used a very large-scale macroeconomic model to look at what growth would have been since 1990 if we had that system in place, and he concluded investment would have been maybe 20-30% greater, job growth higher, and incomes would rise faster. So I hope to your question, I think as we look at tax reform, we need to think about keeping the tax rate relatively low on new investment, trying to make saving as attractive as possible, and perhaps taxing consumption a bit more. Because everybody's aware, we're not saving enough. We're not saving enough for our retirement accounts. We're not investing as much as other countries do as a percent of GDP. So we need to free up funds for investment by saving more so that we can grow faster and hopefully provide jobs for, you know, everybody, including our high school and college graduates.
Dr. Thorning, thank you for coming out, and the council, thank you for sponsoring this. My question is this. For the past 25 years or so in the U.S. Tax code, it's basically been tweaking around the edges, except for, the Bush tax rate changes in a decade or so. But if I recall correctly, the last significant change to the U.S. tax code was a bipartisan effort 25 years ago during the Ronald Reagan administration. What made it successful that time? I'm interested in your experience, or going back and you're intermixing politics with economics, political science in that, public policy. But the players in Washington, D.C. were able to get together and come across with produce a bipartisan change to the tax code.
Well, that's a very important question. It seems to me at the time there was a bit more spirit of give and take than there is now. There was a recognition that our tax code was unduly complex, and they brought down marginal tax rates. They did also eliminate some of the 10% investment tax credit. But nonetheless, it was considered a pretty good step forward. However, within a few short years, the rates started creeping back up on personal income, and corporate income, I think, went from 34% to 35%. So but it didn't address the taxation of foreign source income. It left, it made some changes to it, but it still makes the current system that was put in place in 86 and basically has been tweaked, has made our multinational companies not as competitive because their competitors aren't paying tax on the foreign source income at home. They pay tax in the country they're operating on. So that means when our multinationals, who are hugely important, in terms of research and development here and job growth here too, are not competing on even footing with companies from, say, France or China or our other major competitors. So I don't, I think what's made it difficult now is we have the fiscal cliff. We have the tax cuts expiring at the end of the year. We have the sequestration that's going to cut $100 billion out of federal expenditures at the first of the year, as well as the debt ceiling to roll over. So there's just a lot of pressures that people are very much aware of in Washington to do something, but yet you have a strong contingent of people who are very concerned about, we've got to cut spending, they believe. They don't want to see tax rates go up. Remember that half of all business income is taxed at individual rates. So if the individual rate goes up from 35 to 39.6 plus the 3.8% add-on for the health tax, that means half of all business income is going to be taxed at about 44%. Which is, a big shift from 35. And people are worried about what does that do to their ability to hire people, to be competitive and stay in business. So I think things are more complicated now because of the shift in the taxation. For example, you know, 25 years ago, we didn't have nearly the amount of business income taxed at individual rates as we do now. So there are a host of issues that make it more complicated. Plus, you have the kind of less comity, shall we say, among the members of Congress than we used to have. So it's harder to reach a compromise. Not to say it won't happen. I mean, if we get strong presidential leadership, you know, either from this administration or a new administration, I think it could happen. I think we could see tax reform within the next Congress.
Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Clearly? Good. I see one hand back up there. Maybe I better talk a little louder. I'm a pilot, so I'm used to speaking into the mic, you know. It won't bite. If Alaska's tax system is so terrible, can you explain to me why the 2010 activity period on the North Slope was greater than the 2009, and why the 2011 was greater than the 2010 and it produced activity that hadn't been seen since the construction of TAPS? Can you explain why the construction in 2012 is going to be greater than 2011 and why the construction activity in 2013 is going projected to be greater than 2012? So I have a second question.
Well, in answer to question number one, I expect a lot of the reason that you may be seeing increased activity is that world oil prices have risen. So even with a tax rate of what seems to be considerably higher than the rest of the lower 48, you may see some increased activity. But it seems to me the proof is in the pudding. Oil production is dropping here, and the Department of Revenue estimates show continued drop. So you might have more activity, but I'm not sure you're going to get very many more barrels of oil.
Thank you for speaking.
You're welcome.
Okay, you had mentioned earlier that production in Alaska is decreasing, and Alaskans' budget depend entirely on this oil revenue. You also mentioned some incentives as far as what Alaska needs to start looking into for the future, since we all know that if you're depending on something and it's decreasing so rapidly, and the end consequences may be effects to the people that live here in Alaska and elsewhere that depend on on Alaskan oil. What are some of these incentives that you may suggest to the state of Alaska?
Is your question, what are the incentives that are out there to increase production right now? Is that the question?
Well, I don't know about production. I know maybe there can be some other sites that can be explored and start working on. But in the meantime, the decrease on production and the tax revenue that is eventually going to be affecting Alaskans. You spoke about incentives. Other incentives. What are some advice?
Well, in my understanding, there are some incentives when new production is brought in place, which help reduce the cost of capital. But if those are overwhelmed by the tax rate on any oil that's produced, then you still won't see a strong response from the oil industry in Alaska. You will still find them looking at their options outside Alaska, I think. So it's a question of what the total package is. Even if you have some upfront incentives that may bring in some cash flow, if the upside of a price increase is taken away by the high marginal tax rate here, then it's still not enough to make companies want to do what perhaps they were doing back in the 80s. So that's my take on it.
Hello. As a student in a public school, I am dependent on government funds to supplement my education. I've seen countless cuts in our school district's budget, laying off teachers and cutting educational services recently. With a cut in taxes, would that decrease the monetary income of the government, thus decreasing the school district budget, or would it be offset by the increase in investment in the state?
Well, that's a real good question, and I suspect if there were a lower tax rate on oil produced here, in a matter of a few years, you would see, assuming world oil prices don't plummet, you would see an increase in tax receipts. As long as there's not a sharp cutback in the global price of oil, I would think this would be a more attractive place to invest. Remember, I know you don't notice it because you live here, but it's mighty cold here. And the drilling can only take place, in the exploration and production only take place part of the year. I mean, your climate, I know to you, you don't even notice it, but it is certainly a harder place physically to explore for and produce oil. So all other things equal, I believe, but back to your question, I think it would be helpful to try making it a more attractive place to invest by looking at the ACES tax provision.
Thank you for speaking.
You're welcome.
I was wondering, you've talked about the idea of a consumption tax as opposed to the taxes that we have now, like income taxes, in order to incentivize savings and investment. I would like to point out that the U.S. has much more of a service-based economy, and we're much more consumption-based as opposed to another country like China, which is much more investment-based in terms of human and physical capital. I would also like to question you on the idea of investment driving growth. I would wonder how you would respond to ideas like the solo model in economics, which pose that investment only achieves the short-term growth as opposed to the long-term growth, which is achieved through innovations in efficiency and productivity. Finally, I'd also like to say that this number of 80% taxes on oil in Alaska is disingenuous, because we have a sliding scale of taxes on oil in this state as opposed to other states. So I feel like Alaska's taxes are actually very competitive at normal prices as opposed to prices as high as $100 a barrel or $150 or even like $190, which was the maximum on your slide. So I was wondering how you could respond to that in terms of these problems being independent of Alaska's taxes and much more a product of the larger forces in the global market.
Well, those are all good questions, and I'll try and answer them. If I forget them, you refresh me. But the first one about the role of investment in the U.S. economy and globally, I think even though our economy is more of a service economy than a manufacturing economy, nonetheless, investment is still the driver, whether it's investment in developing new software or new iPads, or whether it's investment in a chemical plant or a mine or an oil and gas field. Without dollars put and capital put in to invest, you're not going to see either better software or more efficient manufacturing. Just to bring home a point about the role of the surge in natural gas production that's been brought about by hydraulic fracturing in the lower 48. The price of natural gas is now down to somewhere around, I guess, 350 million BTU. Is that about right? And we're seeing more chemical plants being built. We're seeing steel production because of the lower cost of energy. So these are good paying jobs, and the investment that's taking place is helping many states enjoy stronger growth. So I think whether you're talking about investment in human capital or physical capital, it's a foundation of our continued prosperity and you know, ability to stay competitive in the world. So I think that is pretty well documented. If we don't continue to invest as a percent of GDP, productivity growth will get ever slower, which will mean no growth at all in real wages. And with respect to the question about Alaska's tax rate, my understanding is after a certain base price of oil and deduction of expenses, the marginal tax rate here applies to every single dollar over that base. So the marginal tax rate here, you know, is up to about 90% over a certain base. So it's not really a sliding scale, is my understanding. And I think the comparisons I put up are probably pretty accurate as to, for example, the Gulf of Mexico oil taxed at, you know, somewhere around 42% marginal rate compared to about 90 in Alaska. And I mean, you can see what's happening in the lower 48 in terms of output compared to what's happening up here. So I think, you know, it's worth taking a look at the tax regime here and see if it could be improved.
Yes, hello. As a college student, I can't help but find myself curious. Have you given a consideration something similar to the roles and contributions to alternative energies and the, what they can give to the overall U.S. energy industry and the economy?
Well, I've taken, as I mentioned, I'm interested in what the cost of energy is, whether it's renewable or fossil or nuclear, because energy prices really have an impact on economic and job growth here. And there is a chart which is in some testimony I gave this year before one of the House or Senate committees that's a DOE EIA, you know, government chart showing the levelized capital cost for building offshore wind, solar photovoltaic, onshore wind, biomass, nuclear, combined cycle, coal, oil generation, and the cost for these renewables is in most cases three or four times the cost, you know, for fossil fuel or even nuclear, and these costs don't count the fact that you have to back up wind and back up solar with all, you know, with some other generation. So these costs understate what the real cost of renewable energy is. We did a comparison of the 30 states, we at ACCF, of the 30 states that have a renewable portfolio standard for renewable energy, and we looked at industrial and the 20 states that don't. The 30 states with that renewable mandate have residential electricity prices that are over 20% higher than those that don't have the mandate, and industrial electricity prices are like 25% higher. So it's clear that mandating expensive renewable energy, you know, you may want to do it for other reasons, but it does tend to increase electricity prices, which all other things equal, it means slower economic growth and less ability on the part of households to spend.
Hello, thank you, Doctor, for coming. Appreciate your comments. I want to first apologize that you've kind of stepped into a major political firestorm here in Alaska.
It's fun.
And the debate largely centers around one camp that believes that we ought to dramatically reduce our taxes in the hopes of enhancing oil recovery in what's called the legacy fields. Mm-hmm. And another camp who wants to generate economic incentives through things like tax credits and enhancing production in the legacy fields, and then giving incentives for new exploration and production, where many believe that that's our future. And I'm going to agree with a couple of people who says, because of the progressivity element of ACES, that the numbers that you're representing in terms of being 80 and 90% only are achieved at very high oil prices, and many of us believe that the progressivity should be relaxed to open up the upside for the oil companies to gain those marginal returns that might be necessary to attract capital. But as a trained economist, as you are, I know it, even if you put 1,000 economists together, we'll never reach a conclusion. Mm-hmm. But in terms of what the oil industry is proposing, which is largely the text of what you're describing today, many people believe that it's relying too much on hope, that it's just a new environment and that we hope that we can get the returns. Wouldn't it be more prudent from a risk management point of view for us to know everything the oil industry knows underground within those legacy fields and do an independent assessment of what reserves are there, what kind of capital costs would be necessary to achieve enhanced production, and whether or not the returns to the oil company is sufficient to induce them to make those investments before we put our path on giving away $2 billion a year that we may never achieve in terms of additional revenue in the future?
Well, I guess I would think it might be, well, in terms of if you're asking the oil companies to give away all their proprietary information about reserves, you know, I'm...
I am. It's the chance of us giving so much away that we go broke in 15 years.
Well, you know, that's something between you and the oil companies, but, you know, I know it's intellectual property, and so they've spent a lot of money to acquire it, and whether you could, you know, I don't know how far down that path you can go, but in terms of setting profit, you know, ceilings on profits and so forth, that's, you know, reminiscent of what went on in Russia for many years, and you saw what happened to their industrial production and their oil output, so I would think it would be wiser to dangle some carrots rather than, you know, enact punitive measures that confiscate returns, if that's what you're suggesting. Well.
Well, Dr. Thorney, thank you for joining us today. And so, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us, and we'll look forward to seeing all of you on our November 16th program here at the Hilton. So please check in the website, and we'll look forward to seeing you again.